Welcome to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast, where SearchHealthIT.com editors interview leading experts on IT strategies for healthcare leaders.
Hello, welcome to our presentation, Using Identity and Access Management Technology in a Healthcare Setting. I'm Jean Degarian, Executive Editor for SearchHealthIT.com. Thanks for joining us. Automated employee identity management systems can improve data security, reduce vulnerable access points, and close security loops. Stephen Gantz, founder and principal architect of SecurityArchitecture.com, is with us to discuss how these systems improve workflow and address privacy rules. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jean. Happy to be here. So we want to talk today a little bit about identity and access management. Identity is a funny word because it has a very well understood, at least most people think they understand it, connotation in a face-to-face context. But it gets a little bit different when we're working electronically. And as we move more and more in healthcare space and other sectors of the world to interacting with people mostly or entirely online, identity becomes a big question. You know, there's a very famous New Yorker cartoon years and years ago in the late 90s that showed a dog on a computer and said, you know, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. So I guess that was supposed to be clever at the time, but it also shows one of the big problems is when you're interacting with somebody online, you don't necessarily know who they are. Now, what we're going to talk about today specifically with identity and access management is more focused on employees in health-related organizations and not just necessarily on everyone in the general public that might be interacting, but a lot of the issues are the same. Depending on the context, depending on why somebody might ask you for information, your information, or you need to see somebody else's, identity is not necessarily enough. Just because you're listening to me, you were just told who I am, you might believe that I am who I am because, you know, I'm here talking to you today, but that doesn't give you very much information. You might want to hear me talk a little bit about some security and privacy issues, but there's probably a lot of things you wouldn't want to share with me, things that have nothing to do with the context that we're interacting. And so the context for interaction is actually very, very important in identity management, and that's a place that organizations are trying to get to with employee identification and any users, not just employees, but contractors and partners and business associates and all those kinds of things. So it's a sort of a big, messy kettle of fish in some ways, but we're going to talk through a few key issues. But what this all boils down to is who is accessing the data, when, and why. And we want to be able to keep track of that kind of stuff and keep some control over it. And if it's your data, even if you're not the employee, if it's your data and you're relying on an organization, a hospital, a doctor's office, a government agency, they have some of your data, you have a vested interest in answering those questions as well. Who is accessing your data, when, and why? And is it all appropriate? And those are perfectly valid questions for you to ask. It's your data. It's about you. But organizations have different ways to go about managing this. So one of the key issues with identity management is we need good, solid identification, who you are, and authentication that sort of validates if somebody claims that they are a certain person, that they are really that person, and have the privileges that go along with being that person. Those are sort of the fundamental basis for what we call online trust. You know, can you trust people to do the right thing or to give them information? It's not enough for you to trust somebody, but at least it's a starting point. You really can't get much further if you don't have identification. So the broader the scope, the harder it is to manage all this kind of stuff. We talk about this term called credentials. You know, the credential most people have is a driver's license or some other form of government-issued ID. That is a credential that has your name on it, and if it's a driver's license, also means something. It means that you know how to drive, or at least your state believes that you know how to drive. The broader the scope, the more things we might be talking about, not just healthcare, but banking and shopping and where your kids go to school and the kinds of things you might be doing, what kinds of licenses you might have, those kinds of things, the harder it gets to manage credentials. And in the physical world, it's just you. You have you, you're your name, people know you, they know you by sight, they interact with you personally. Online, you may have many, many different identities and different attributes depending on context. Think about how many different websites you log into. Now, maybe you change your username and password everywhere you go, as security experts recommend, and maybe you don't. But you're logging into your bank site to pay some bills online is a very different experience than you might have logging on to an e-commerce site to shop for some things. And the interest is different there. The amount of data that gets shared and the nature of the data that gets shared there is also different. And so the level of identification authentication we might use is also very different. You might have different attributes in every context. You absolutely have to be doing identification to sort of get us down to do any of these wonderful information exchange kinds of applications, whether we're in healthcare or some other sector. So that's why it's important to get a handle on some of these issues. Now, as usual, there are some legal requirements and considerations, at least in the healthcare world, when we're talking about identity. there's two separate sort of issues that come up, at least under the HIPAA rules and in the healthcare sort of regulatory world. One is the organization. Are you a healthcare organization? Are you a specific type of healthcare organization that is regulated under HIPAA? Are you a healthcare provider or a plan or a clearinghouse, which means you do something value-added with data? Or are you a business associate? Do you work with organizations that are what they call HIPAA-covered entities? It's important to know just what that organization is and that the organization is what it is. Are you a durable medical equipment provider that sells things like wheelchairs and crutches and stuff like that? Are you really? You know, the government certainly wants to know that you are and that you're not pretending to be and submitting fraudulent claims for reimbursement to Medicare. But if you're going to do business with somebody, it's important that people know what that the organization is really the type of organization it says it is. We call that entity identification. What kind of organization are you, and are you really in the healthcare business? Because if you're not, we don't think we should be sharing a lot of healthcare data with you. Once you get past the organization, there's the individual level. It's fine to know that where I live in the Northern Virginia area, we have Inova Healthcare, this big hospital network. So it's fine to know that you're at a hospital that's part of the Inova Healthcare system. That gives me something. But there's thousands and thousands of employees in that organization. And some of them are doctors and nurses and clinicians, and some of them are janitorial staff, and some of them are administrative staff, and some of them do billing. They all have different roles. And we don't want to just give everybody the same kind of access. So there are actually rules under HIPAA, not just for entity identification, but also for individual user identification. And HIPAA, for instance, requires that unique usernames are required for identifying and tracking users and the kinds of things they do in the organization. So certainly in a computer world, that means we don't share logins. No matter what you see on ER or some of the other TV shows, I guess ER is off the air now, but any other hospital-based TV show, you're not really supposed to be sharing logins to medical data in a hospital or any other environment. You're supposed to have, under the rules, under the laws, you're supposed to have unique individual login so that we have some idea to answer that question I asked up front, which is who is accessing your data, and really should they be doing that. There are all sorts of other federal requirements that come out depending on what you're trying to do. There's something called e-authentication that goes to something called identity proofing, which says, if you say you are who you are, what does it take to convince me? What form of ID do I need to see? How many forms of ID do I need to see? Do they need to have a photo on them? Do they need to be government issued? And all those kinds of rules that says, how far are we going to go before we actually believe that Steve Gantz is Steve Gantz? And that's actually the one that we were talking about. So there's all sorts of different rules based on the type of data that's flowing back and forth. There's different rules for public interaction, like using the web, than there are for internal systems that would also be user access controlled, but that aren't exposed to things like the internet. There are government-led initiatives like the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. It's kind of a mouthful. But the idea is, why should you have so many different places to go to say, this is who I am, different forms of identification online? Wouldn't it be handy if there was a way to manage that and manage the different contexts so you didn't have to keep it updated in all these different places? That's just getting off the ground, but that's at least an initiative where people are trying to get that sorted. In the health information technology context, where we talk about electronic health data, there are identification and authentication standards, technical enabling standards that say, here's how you could make that work, and also standards in terms of the rules that you have to follow. There are calls for what we call strong identity proofing to combat fraud, which is a big problem in the U.S., at least, and probably most healthcare systems. There's also a need for something called non-repudiation, where you're changing information. If I ask you for information and you send it to me, you want to make sure that not only that I'm me, but that I'm actually the one that asked you for the information. If your doctor asks another doctor for information about you, one of your health records, those doctors want to be pretty clear, not just that they're both doctors and they both have you as a patient in common and they have a right to see your information, but that a request that one doctor received from the other actually came from the other doctor and wasn't somebody impersonating that doctor, trying to intercept your health records to perpetrate identity theft or medical identity theft. So non-repudiation means that somebody has confidence that who the person asking for the information actually asked for the information before we send it back, and that request can be traced back to them. All these things are fairly important when we're getting ready to exchange data and not just look at it where it lives. There's different ways to approach all this, as you might imagine, different technical and business approaches to do it. As I mentioned before, in the online world, we may have one identity, but we have lots of different contexts. There's different things you might want to do online, even within the healthcare setting, right? Billing and treatment are two very different contexts that have different purposes. So one approach that many technical companies have gone down a road with is called claims-based identity, which says we want to start with an individual and be sure that that individual is who the individual says he or she is. But after that, what we want to deal with, the set of attributes or the set of information, the data fields that we might want to attach to that identity, are likely to change based on the context. You might ask for more information to identify or to authorize someone if they're asking for a health record than if they were asking for an e-commerce transaction or something like that. So the recognition of claims-based identity says, well, different information is probably going to be needed, and a different organization, two different healthcare providers, or two different electronic organizations might ask you for different sets of information. If you've done an online transaction recently using a credit card, some places ask you for that little code that's different than the credit card number and the expiration date. Some organizations don't. It's a good idea from a security standpoint to always ask people for that code, because then we're sure that the person giving the credit information actually has the card, but not everybody asks. So there's different sets of information that might be asked depending on who's doing the asking. Part of the idea also from a privacy standpoint is if you're really, really clear on what set of information we need, then we can limit the disclosure of information to only the set of data that's actually required. So we don't over-disclose any data. I'm not going to give you more information than you need to complete the business transaction or submit my claim or do my billing. I'm not going to give you a whole lot of superfluous information that you don't really need to finish that transaction because I am trying to protect my privacy and I don't want to give you that extra information. There's another approach that people use different than claims-based identity that's called federated identity. It says we can't all trust each other. We don't know everybody. We don't have not everybody has the same standing in our eyes. So can we have a single credential that might be accepted for identification authentication in multiple different contexts? If you're a hospital employee, you might have a standard username and password or standard credential that you would use to logging into your own system. But what if that hospital is also affiliated with another organization? Can you use your hospital identification to verify your identity somewhere else? Well, the answer is yes. Technically, we can absolutely do that. There's some things that you might have to do to set that up and make sure it works right. There's lots of different technical approaches to do it, but it's sort of a nice idea if people can make that work. There's some risks that go along with that approach that we'll talk about in a second, but at least the idea of not having to have a separate set of credentials for every single place you might interact is sort of a handy thing. Just like people like single sign-on, so they don't have to remember quite so many passwords where they work. There are some challenges, and a big one goes out to actually giving you the credential. If you are an employee of an organization, you enroll and you fill out an employment application and you get hired and you fill out your I-9 to verify that you're legal to work in the United States, and you have to give some ID to do that. And then you're given a credential. It might be a username and a password. It might be a badge that gets you into the building or maybe even gets you into your computer, depending on what kind of badge it happens to be. And you use and use and use and reuse that credential. I mentioned a driver's license before. You get a driver's license so you can drive, to prove that you know how to drive. But when you get on a plane, you also give your driver's license to the person working for the Transportation Security Administration to prove that you are who you are. So that same credential that was issued for one very specific purpose, so you can drive a car legally, is used in other contexts. That's really, really handy. So you don't need a separate I get to fly credential from an I get to drive credential. That's nice for people to have. But to be able to rely on a credential, you have to know who issued it and have some confidence in the issuer. I'll go back to the driver's license. Every state in the United States issues their own driver's licenses. The process is very similar that you go through, but I've been licensed in three different states at three different times, and I know that it's not exactly the same everywhere. After 9/11, that process changed a little bit. Congress got a little bit nervous about just how easy it was to get a driver's license in some states compared to others. So they tried to implement some new standards that said, let's make sure we really do a good job checking on people before we give them a driver's license. Because once you have that driver's license, you can use it as proof of identity in a lot of different places. If the organization that issues the credentials, this would be any organization, isn't doing a good job of validating who the user is and identity proofing when they issue the credential, that's a bad thing, and bad things can happen. You can have fraud, you can have theft, you can have criminal behavior. So it's really, really important that we have some confidence in who's doing it. There are all sorts of identity management programs out there that depend on a trusted issuer, and sometimes there's third-party services out there that do this. It happens on the Internet all the time. There was a fairly high-profile case about a month and a half ago with an online credential provider called DigiNotar, like a digital notary. They're very popular in Europe. They're used a little bit less often here, but the entire Dutch government relied on DigiNotar certificates for all its government websites that its citizens were interacting with. And it turns out that DigiNotar's security wasn't very good. And somebody was able to go in and get its private key that was used to sign all its certificates and could start issuing fraudulent certificates. Well, if you don't know which certificates are real and which ones are fraudulent, you have no way to trust the ones that you're presented. DigiNotar actually quite quickly went out of business after this happened because nobody could trust any of the stuff they were providing. It became a really big problem for the Dutch government. They couldn't do any online services with their citizenry until they got a substitute system in place. But it shows the importance of making sure that whoever's issuing the credentials is really on the up and up and is really trusted. Technical capabilities are not always sufficient to determine whether somebody is trustworthy. You really need some process that vets, that really checks up on the information that's being provided, that we don't just take people at their word all the time. People also want to move towards universal identification to healthcare. So there's a sort of master ID, whether you're a patient, whether you're an organization, a doctor, things like that. And for doctors, you know, there's a license database out there that says all doctors who are licensed to practice in the United States are registered in this database. Anyone who can write a prescription in the United States has a unique ID that the Drug Enforcement Agency issues that says you are actually okay to write prescriptions because they want to keep track of these kinds of things. So there's certain places where there are really universal identifiers where everybody who has that ability is stored in a certain place. But that's kind of the exception rather than the rule. We don't have very much universal identification right now. There's a bunch of reasons for this. One is there's a lot of different technical approaches that can do it. There's a lot of different standards out there. In some countries, especially including the U.S., there is strong resistance to the idea of nationalized anything, national IDs. Even though we all have social security numbers, people sort of resist the idea that there would be a national identifier that would be used for things like patient identification in almost any context, healthcare or otherwise. And so there's some political resistance that has to be overcome. Even when you don't have those barriers, there are still issues about making sure that any credential you put out there can actually be used in all the different contexts you might want to use it for. So even within healthcare, we're having trouble coming up with one approach that would satisfy all the different reasons we might share data in a healthcare context. Also, any solution for broad public consumption beyond just the employees in an individual organization has to be durable. It has to last for a long time. It also has to support scenarios or situations where an individual type of transaction might happen very infrequently. Think about the Social Security Administration or Medicare or some of these other organizations. You might not interact with them very often. Social Security Administration, people go years between transactions with these folks, at least until they retire and actually receiving Social Security benefits. So how do we manage identity and identity credentials over that long period of time? If it might be 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 years, there would be a whole different system in place between transactions. And those are very challenging things to address that the technology hasn't quite sorted out yet, or the process side. So we're really coming out on all this in terms of what organizations can do with their employees and managing identity management and access management is a couple of different related processes. There's the enrollment or sign-up process when you first get verified and you first get your ID or your credential and what it happens to be. And identity proofing is really the big piece there. And then there's identity maintenance, keeping it all current. Are you still a valid employee? Have you done anything bad that would cause your credentials to be revoked? How do we update your information to keep it current? How do we revalidate the attributes and the credentials so they're still okay? And how do we deal with regular things that change all the time? So there's a whole maintenance process that happens. Then there's the authentication part that says, how do we use all that good identity information to actually authenticate users when they need to do different kinds of transactions? What's the context? What are the requirements associated with that context? And then lastly, what do we do when things really change? When an employee leaves the organization, how do we revoke credentials? How do we turn something off that was turned on previously, whether that's for an expiration date or somebody decided they don't want to participate in that service anymore, or for some other reason their credentials need to be canceled. All those separate pieces, those four sort of main processes, enrollment, maintenance, authentication, and sort of termination or revocation, are all wrapped up in this identity management environment. And you can't really do any one of them effectively unless you think about all of them, because as soon as you think you have it set, something in your environment will change and you'll need to make sure you can address those other pieces. So that's sort of the landscape that people are focused on right now from an organizational standpoint. And I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for listening to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast. For more information and resources about healthcare technology and electronic health records, please visit SearchHealthIT.com. Thank you.